from 90.9 WBUR. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Coming up, Massachusetts Congresswoman Catherine Clark will talk about the future of the Democratic Party and women in politics. Also today, one man's experience using psychedelic drugs to treat his opioid addiction.
As far as I see, this is going to change my perspective on life.
Plus, Ayanna Pressley, soon-to-be Congresswoman Pressley, on her legislative priorities and heading to November, how other candidates might replicate her victory.
We built a movement. This was a people-powered, broad, deep, and diverse grassroots coalition that we built one door, one voter, one living room at a time.
And making the case for the relevance of Louisa May Alcott's Little Women 150 years after it was written.
I just know I'll never fit in anywhere.
Joe, you have so many extraordinary gifts. How can you expect to lead an ordinary life?
That's all coming up next on WBUR's Radio Boston.
Thanks for listening to the Radio Boston podcast. If you'd like to support WBUR, go to radioboston.org and click the pledge button in the upper right-hand corner. Okay, back to the show.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Today marks the 17th anniversary of the terrorist attacks on September 11th, 2001, a day that forever changed our country. Earlier today, Massachusetts public officials joined families, friends of victims to remember those we lost.
At the rising of the sun and at its going down, we remember them.
Dorothy Alma DeRuggio, Captain Gerald DeConto, U.S. Navy.
At the blowing of the wind and in the chill of winter, we remember them.
Christine Jonna Barbuto, Graham Berkeley.
At the opening of the buds and in the rebirth of spring, we remember them.
And my beloved daughter, Susan Blair.
And my beloved brother, Kevin Patrick Connors.
And my beloved son, William Christopher Hunt.
And my beloved husband, Kenneth Albert Zellman.
As long as we live, they too will live, for they are now a part of us as we remember them.
17 years later, this is Radio Boston. Congresswoman Catherine Clark is in the studio with us. Welcome. I just wanted to ask you before we talk about some of the issues of today in Congress, in Washington, your reflections on this 9/11 anniversary.
Yes, just hearing that roster of names just brings back so much of the emotion 17 years later. But I remember first hearing about a plane going into the tower, dropping off my children at childcare, and one of the teachers was just weeping, listening to a radio. And it really didn't hit me until we kept driving into work. And by the time I got to the office, it just felt like the world was collapsing around us. Mm-hmm. And what I remember especially, though, were in the weeks and days that followed these horrible atrocities, there was the way we treated each other in traffic, at the grocery store. It really did bring out people's compassion and sense of community.
Right.
And I hope that as we mark this very solemn day in our history, we can hope to recapture that as well.
Yeah, if there is any good that can come out of such a horrific day. Well, thank you. I think it must have changed the lives of your now your constituents, of all of us in news as well. Let's get to some of those policy issues for the people you represent in Massachusetts, the 5th District, which is Medford and Revere, Waltham and Framingham. And one issue that has been a big priority for you, as it is for the people in the state, is child care and the cost of child care. You are trying to, through policy, make it more affordable. What is the issue in Massachusetts, but also beyond Massachusetts, that's making it so expensive, and what are you trying to do?
Yeah, we hear about this almost everywhere I go, whether it's talking to constituents that I run into at the grocery store or come to my office hours or traveling the country. This issue really affects working families, and it affects us on a number of levels. One is the fact that 2/3 of families have working moms, and that they need childcare to be successful in the workplace. And that is why we get so much support for this issue from businesses that understand this is truly a workforce issue. But then we also know that quality early education gives kids a head start that has them ready to learn when they hit kindergarten. And it's really all about having them reading at grade level by the time they hit third grade. And a great way to do that is to give them a quality early education experience.
So you have legislation, and maybe we can get an update. It's not new, that this policy that you proposed, a 21st Century Child Care Investment Act. This came out more than a year ago, if I understand
that
correctly.
Right.
So what is the latest with that? What is the movement? And of course, in theory, members of Congress may support the idea of this, but this is a tax credit, right, for families, which people would also, I generally assume, support. Where is it going at this point?
So at this point, it is not seen a lot of action, frankly. It has not had a hearing under the Republican leadership. I don't think this has garnered a lot of support. But the reason we're talking about it is because we think it is so relevant to issues we're discussing in this election and to really raise awareness around this issue for working families. As I said, this child care can be one of the biggest expenses, especially here in Massachusetts. We see close to $20,000 a year as an expense if you have an infant or a toddler for child care costs.
So I imagine, though, that when we have these really wonderful things that happen in policy where minimum wage goes up and goes up incrementally, that that's also impacting businesses, of course, and impacting businesses like child care centers, preschools and such. So the other progressive policies that are changing work lives for the better are also impacting the costs of things like childcare. I don't know if you, on a national level, are sussing that. Massachusetts is one state with a different minimum wage law in place that's changing things here.
Yeah, still the average in Massachusetts for a child care provider and teacher is $12 an hour. I know that my son has a part-time job at college washing dishes that he makes $15 an hour at. And you see some variance, but that's another part of this workforce issue, is how do we value this very critical work with our early educators and make sure that a predominantly woman-based workforce is earning enough money to be able to provide for their own families.
So I'm sure then you have then been aware of the study of that the workforce, women in the workforce, the numbers have leveled off since the 1990s. The New York Times had a report last month. So even though women are earning more money, they're earning college degrees, they're out in the field, they are also pushing themselves to delay marriage and childbirth because of the cost of raising children.
That's
so
right.
That's another conundrum to balance off here. It doesn't bode well necessarily for this kind of Child Care Investment Act if these other things are happening. If less women are in the workplace because of the issue, will it address the workforce too?
Well, we're hoping that it's going to be part of the solution for families, and that if we can help reduce that cost of childcare while allowing families the flexibility to pick their provider, we're going to do several things. We're going to allow people to stay in the workforce. We're going to allow people to be able to pursue education and be able to jump up to a better paying job. And we're going to give the workforce of the future with the children the very best start that they can.
Can you, in a nutshell, just so I can get you on some other topics, just lay out what the tax credit could be if this were to go forward?
So the tax credit will be available to families up to 400% of the poverty level, which in Massachusetts for a family of four is $100,000 in income. And it would be a maximum benefit of $14,000 a year. So it won't pay your entire child care costs, but it can really make a difference to a family to get the child care into a more appropriate percentage of their family budget.
All right. So maybe women in the workforce, numbers are leveling off. Let's talk about women in politics, because this is where the numbers are beginning to soar, right?
That's right.
So we just saw this play out in the Massachusetts primary this election year. 122 female candidates ran for congressional and state office, and 89 of them are still standing after the primary going forward. Kivis, your prescription of more women getting involved in politics. So is this a short-lived trend, or are we turning a corner in this particular area of work?
I don't think it is a short-lived trend. And the trend is that women are running and women are winning. And so I hope that this is really showing that women understand the power of their political voice and it being at the table. And I think that when they see success and role models and other women running, it is going to encourage more women to get involved. So I don't think this is going to be limited to these midterms or to 2018. I think this will be a long overdue, long-term trend.
You and I talked for just a moment before we went on air about what the kinds of issues that might come to the fore if more women are in office. What are those issues? I mean, is it when we say women's issues, that's really putting us in a hole. So what were you thinking? What were you thinking before I stopped you from saying it off air?
Well, I think that women tend to run not to be someone, but to do something. And I can tell you the issues that are resonating around the country with candidates I'm working with is primarily health care. And when they saw the Republican leadership and, frankly, usually the member of Congress these women are running against, try and take away health care from families in their districts, deem women as a pre-existing condition, being a woman, and then remove the protections for people with pre-existing conditions. We see, I'll give you a good example of a candidate out in Illinois, Betsy Dirksen-Londrigan. She is running because her Republican congressman voted to take away health care. And she had a son who had a tick bite that turned into a horrendous experience. And she said, never once did I look at that ventilator that was keeping him alive and ask who was going to pay for that. And she really believes that nobody in this country should have to ask that question and make choices when their family's in a crisis. And that is the type of story and authenticity that we are seeing women candidates and Democratic candidates bringing to the campaign trail across mm-hmm. the country.
Let's bring it closer to home and talk about Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley's win in the 7th District. What is your reaction to her defeat of longtime Congressman Capuano, Michael Capuano?
Well, I think Ayanna's win is a historical one, and I think it's really good news for the Democratic Party because it is showing that energy out there. Ayanna was able to bring new voters to really inspire young people to get involved. And that is what another trend that we are seeing, that the energy that started for many people with the Women's March has not dissipated, but is in fact growing. And I think one of the strengths of the Democratic caucus is our diversity in race and gender, in geography. And it's really my hope that we can bring the power and strength of that diversity to governing if we can win the majority in November.
So in a few minutes, we're going to hear from Ayanna Pressley. She spoke earlier today with WBUR's political reporter, Anthony Brooks. So we're going to hear about where she is after the election, after the Labor Day breakfast as well. She spoke about her track record, that she ran on her track record, not a campaign, about being a Black woman, and that came up in the local politics or the Democratic Party not exactly supporting her run. Can you talk about the elements that you see Councillor Pressley bringing with her to Congress that maybe Congressman Capuano could not bring or did not bring because of who she is and her track record?
Well, I think Ayanna has always been a voice that is a powerful one for women and girls. And she's been very, very honest about her own experiences growing up, attend a private school, be one of the few children and students of color at that school, not having a relationship with her dad growing up, being sexually assaulted in college, and ultimately having to drop out to help support her mom. Those experiences Ayanna brings with such authenticity and passion to the work that she does. And I think she's going to be an incredible member of the delegation.
I want to ask you about your desire to be a part of the leadership of the delegation, but also about the Massachusetts Democratic establishment. Before we leave this for a moment, as I said, the Massachusetts Democratic establishment did not support her candidacy. Is there something that has to be repaired now that she is likely, unless there is a write-in candidate that is so strong, she will be in Congress with you, with anybody who's going to be in Congress next after this election? Is there repair that has to be done, and will you be able to manage some of this, maybe as the vice president of the caucus or the vice caucus chair?
Well, I certainly hope so. The reason I'm running for that position is going back to what we were just discussing about the diversity of the caucus and making sure that those voices are heard throughout our caucus, that we are once again strengthening the committee process, and that we are really getting the very different perspectives that is our strength informing what we do and how we set those priorities. So that's why I'm running. And I think that, you know, with Ayanna's race, I think she, again, is a great example of the trends that we're seeing around the country of people making a strong connection.
Yeah, and there's a division in this party, though. So how, you know, what will your job be if you were to become vice chair, including from this most recent race? But there's been a division or there's been an identity crisis going on for some time now in the Democratic Party.
So speaking specifically about this race, many of us did support Mike Capuano. He has been an excellent congressman with a very progressive voting record. But Ayanna's won. And we will treat her as part of the delegation family. And I think that her win is going to bring a perspective and that is needed. And I think she's going to find a very warm and receptive greeting in Congress.
We were speaking also a little bit ago about, before the mics went on, about where you came from. You came from school committee membership. You came from not a political background necessarily, a savvy woman, well-educated, but you came into politics via the school committee. And now, you could be a major player, leader in Congress. I want to know also your take on Nancy Pelosi and her resuming her role as speaker, and if you support that role.
So, yes, I ran a very courageous race for school committee where there were 8 people running for 9 open spots. So it was an easy way to get into politics, but really taught me about listening to people and the power of sort of being at the end of the mandate food chain. Being on a school committee, you have to find solutions that work for parents who are very invested in their children, but you don't have a lot of tools to control your budget or what those mandates are. And I've hoped that I've been able to remember those lessons and connections as we move up. And as we look at the new leadership, I think I am hoping and I am going to be working every day to make sure that we regain control of the majority in the House, because I think it's so critical for the American people.
So if you do regain control of the House, do you support Nancy Pelosi resuming her role as Speaker of the House?
Well, let me tell you why I've supported Nancy in the past. And that's because she has given me opportunities to work on issues that mean a lot to me, whether it's childcare, the opiate crisis, housing, online abuse and harassment. And she has been very supportive of those efforts. Our job number one is going to be making sure we have the majority. And we will see from that race. But I am open to supporting Nancy Pelosi for speaker again.
It is complex because not every Democrat, even in the Massachusetts delegation, is in support of that. There is, as we were saying, there's a fissure here. You know, there is some repair to be done. Do you think that she could hurt the races? If do you worry that Pelosi could hurt the Democrats in the close races around the country going forward into November?
I don't think that. You know, I think the reason that we're seeing her come up in so much of the negative political advertising is because Republicans don't have a positive message to run on. They tried to strip health care from millions of Americans. They gave, tax cuts of over $1 trillion to the largest corporations and to the wealthiest Americans, and are making that winner's circle so small. And our candidates are successful because of the connection they're making to the issues that families care about at home. So, no, I don't think that these attacks and trying to link them to Nancy Pelosi are going to be what wins or loses elections.
All right. I think we have time for one more question. And I'd like to know your take at this point of this year. Should members of Congress be doing more to push back on the Trump administration? This is post the now famous, infamous New York Times op-ed that came out, I believe it's just last week. God, what a busy week in the world it's been, the anonymous op-ed revealing what it reveals about the Trump administration. Where are you with members of Congress pushing back on the Trump administration as a Democrat?
Oh, well, I think you've seen the Democrats pushing back.
And then your colleagues, the Republicans, take them on too. What do you think should be done?
You know, and what we're dealing with is complicity of the Republican leadership and members who absolutely have failed to hold this administration accountable or stand up to the president, whether it's separation of families, whether it's the comments after Charlottesville. It's just such a long list of just insults and really just a administration in chaos. So the best thing we could do is win the House and open those investigations, start to hold this administration accountable, and get back to working on health care and infrastructure and cleaning up corruption in politics and put the American people's agenda back on the table.
All right, Catherine Clark, I'm sorry to have to end it here. I want to thank you very much, Congressman Catherine Clark, who represents Massachusetts 5th District, and that's Malden, Woburn, Lexington, Sudbury, other towns as well. Thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Jill.
Stay with us. There's more ahead. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. Some people desperate to end their opioid addiction are experimenting with new, sometimes unapproved treatment methods. One that's attracting a lot of attention is treatment with psychedelic drugs, including the plant substance ibogaine. Enthusiasts say it can eliminate drug cravings for some patients experiencing withdrawal. But since it's legal in the U.S., people who want to try it have to travel outside the country. WBUR's Deborah Becker has been following a New Hampshire man as he seeks out ibogaine treatment. Part one of her story aired yesterday, and now part two as Deb follows Dustin Dextrace to Mexico.
So this is nice. You have a view of the Pacific Ocean.
Beautiful out here.
This well-appointed home in a gated residential community perched on a hill just south of Tijuana is the Experience Ibogaine Clinic. Inside this house and the one next door, medical staff treat addiction using the psychedelic ibogaine. 36-year-old Dustin Dextrace will be here for about a week.
As far as I see, this is going to change my perspective on life, and it's going to open me up to be able to move forward.
Dextrace came here desperate after cycling through treatment and jail. Just last month, he tried to kill himself. Then his friends offered to help pay the $5,000 for him to travel here to take ibogaine. It's a plant substance that's said to completely eliminate opioid withdrawal symptoms and cravings. Ibogaine also often causes hallucinations or a psychedelic trip, and it's said that it's not always a positive one.
I was a little nervous about that, but I'm just going to remind myself that, like, this is in my head and, like, none of it's real. Nothing can hurt me.
The psychedelic properties are one reason it's illegal in the U.S. Another, the health risks, especially to the heart. Ibogaine has been blamed for at least 19 deaths, mostly in those with underlying heart conditions.
You know, it's still absolutely crucial to have medical staff here, you know, because it is a dangerous substance. It's cardiotoxic.
Aiden Smith Ahern is the clinic's treatment coordinator. He came to Mexico from his native Massachusetts 6 years ago for his own ibogaine treatment. He says that inspired him to stay, to help others get it too. Smith Ahern says most patients seek ibogaine after several tries at conventional treatment.
Just having gone through the hell that most of these people have gone through, and because of how the American health system set up, I just feel like there's not a lot of hope for people over there.
Smith Ahern estimates that this clinic alone has treated more than 1,000 people, more than 95% of them from the U.S. Among those on the clinic staff is Dr. Paul Castillas, who's an emergency room doctor in Mexico. At the clinic, He works to make sure patients are medically clear, and he administers the Ibogaine. He estimates that about 40% of the people who take Ibogaine stay off drugs long term. Dr. Castillas became an Ibogaine enthusiast after a friend who owned another clinic asked him to help monitor patients.
When they arrive, cloud and and their eyes, and after that, they shiny eyes, smiling, alive, basically.
Dr. Castillo says although Ibogaine is not illegal in Mexico, it's not exactly sanctioned. So this clinic follows treatment guidelines from the Global Ibogaine Therapy Alliance, which is a Canadian nonprofit. The guidelines recommend continually monitoring patients, especially their hearts. He starts testing dextrase.
I'm just going to check your blood pressure.
The treatment is partly spiritual, Dr. Castillo says, so he and the nurses try to help dextrase relax. Dextrase has been taking a short-acting opioid to prevent him from getting sick. When he starts to go into withdrawal, Dr. Castillo gives him the capsule of Ibogaine.
Okay, and in a little bit, we're going to give you a test dose and okay. Start with this, okay?
Okay, sounds good. I feel a little nauseous to my stomach.
That's good.
Dextrase lays back on a double bed, hooked up to medical monitors with a sleeping mask over his eyes.
I feel a little warm here and there, and like I feel something starting to happen a little bit, but then I'm just relaxed. I feel relaxed. Normally in withdrawal, I would be able to like relax like this.
For about the next 10 hours, Dextrase lies in the darkened room, mostly quiet. The medical staffers stay with him most of the night. The next morning, he describes sometimes feeling as if his body was vibrating. He also saw visions, he says, which were like someone showing him photos of all the negative things he's done.
I don't want to go into detail about a lot of the stuff that I saw. It's kind of just for me to, you know. At first, it seemed like it was like not the greatest experience because it really wasn't the greatest experience, but it was exactly what I needed.
And how does it feel to you this morning in terms of withdrawal symptoms?
There's no withdrawal whatsoever. Like, I feel none whatsoever.
It's not clear exactly how Ibogaine eliminates withdrawal. That's now being researched by pharmaceutical companies, which are trying to remove the psychoactive experience. But that spiritual experience, or the trip, say many treatment providers, is just as important. 3 days after Dustin Dextrase takes the Ibogaine, Smith Ahern prepares another substance, the powerful psychedelic called 5-MeO-DMT.
It's really life-changing. You're about to see with Dustin. It's mind-blowing.
Smith Ahern puts a sand-like substance into a small glass pipe and lights it. Dextrase inhales, holds it for a few seconds, lies back on a bed in the treatment room, and almost immediately starts intensely tripping.
Yeah, dude. Ah. I knew it, man. Ah. Thank you. Oh, God, yes. Ah. Whew.
After about 20 minutes, Dextrase is coherent again, but emotional.
I understand now. I understand. Oh, man.
Dextrase describes his experience as enlightening and calming, which researchers say is typical. Dr. Alan Davis is a postdoctoral fellow at Johns Hopkins University. He surveyed about 500 people who took 5-MeO-DMT, and he found that most reported mental health benefits from the experience.
It's not a controlled study, so I don't want to make too much of that, but in terms of a signal, it seems to be that there are some people who are reporting that they're experiencing benefit.
Dr. Davis also did a small study of people who used Ibogaine. That found that 80% of survey respondents said their opioid withdrawal symptoms were completely eliminated by Ibogaine. But the study found what Dr. Davis says is a significant problem.
Largely absent is any follow-up aftercare. So people who might return might not have the support they need to really continue making changes in their life.
Dustin Dextrase works with the clinic to determine what kind of support he'll get when he returns home. Tomorrow, we follow him back to New Hampshire.
That's WBUR's Deborah Becker. You can hear part three of her series tomorrow on Radio Boston. Head over to WBUR.org to hear the first part and for photos of the clinic in Mexico. One week ago, Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley stunned the Democratic Party and trounced 10-term incumbent Congressman Michael Capuano in the 7th Congressional District primary. WBUR's senior political reporter Anthony Brooks spoke to Pressley today about her victory, and he joins us now. Hi, Anthony.
Hey, how you doing?
I guess the big question is, how did she do it?
Well, exactly. This race was just the latest reminder of the limits of polling, conventional political expectations, and strategy. Pressley had much less money than Capuano, and she won without the advantages of incumbency, waging a grassroots campaign that delivered a stunning upset victory, as you mentioned. So here's our conversation, beginning with the very question, Jill, that you asked. You ran a grassroots campaign that in many ways defied and challenged conventional ideas about political campaigns. How do you describe what you did? In other words, how you won?
We built a movement. This was a people-powered, broad, deep, and diverse grassroots coalition that we built one door, one voter, one living room at a time.
You expanded the electorate.
We expanded the electorate. And I knew we were doing that all along. And I said many times on the trail that I knew we were doing something that made people uncomfortable by primarying a Democrat, but I felt that there was nothing traitorous about what we were doing, that we were demonstrating great loyalty and, in fact, meeting the challenge and charge we were given of 2016, and that was to ignite the electorate and to grow it. The things that I believe that we did that were game-changing and that I hope that others will take note of and build up this muscle, because this is about the strength of our democracy and the future of our party, is to not make assumptions about who is a likely voter. It's so critical that we are intentional about engaging new voices. We invested resources in ethnic and specialty media. We built this grassroots coalition that was intergenerationally diverse, socioeconomically, racially, culturally. And our victory was a testament less as a referendum against hate, but a mandate for hope, for aspiration, for vision, for boldness.
You made reference to the fact, essentially, that you bucked the establishment. You not only ran against a 10-term incumbent, you ran against a Democratic Party establishment and included Boston Mayor Marty Walsh, Congressman Joe Kennedy, former Governor Deval Patrick, even civil rights icon John Lewis, the Congressional Black Caucus. Was that hard for you?
Truthfully, it wasn't, because I was prepared. I knew exactly what I was embarking upon and had fully expected that this would be an uphill climb and a lonely walk and very bruising. And some days and some hours, I think specifically about the Labor Day breakfast, that was a very hard day.
Why the Labor Day breakfast? I mean, what was hard about that for you?
It was painful because this nagging and persistent charge that had been lobbied against me throughout the campaign of identity politics was permeating so many rooms that I was in. And so, you know, I'm no ambitious upstart. I'm ambitious about change, but I'm no ambitious upstart. And I had been a foot soldier in the trenches with so many people that I was in that room with that day. And some of them were, you know, not their usual warm self. And many of them told me, you know, to my face how frustrated they were by
that
the fact
you were running.
That I was running, and specifically brought up the issue of identity politics, which I found incredibly hurtful.
And that's hurtful because it tried to sort of synthesize your entire candidacy into you're a woman of color, and that's sort of it.
Correct.
Yeah.
And what was most painful about that, you know, is that we call ourselves Democrats. And that play was a very predictable play from the GOP handbook, and not one that I had expected. But that is all behind us now. I'm ready to get to work.
Well, let me ask you about that work, because one of the central issues in your campaign, it's a powerful one, is this issue of income inequality in the 7th. We know it's true. It's one of the wealthiest districts in the country. And as you pointed out, it's one of the most economically unequal. And you also made the point that this has been true long before Trump. It's been the case under Republican and Democratic administrations. So my question for you, as you go down to Congress, what can you do about it? What is the sort of one or two policy priorities that can take on that vexing issue?
Well, the thing is that there is no one single way to get at that.
Yeah.
Economic inequality is the consequence of, you know, so many other issues, mm-hmm. from housing to transportation to wages. So some of the things that I'll be advocating for is the canceling of student debt, addressing the cost of childcare, right alongside with that, the fight for 15, and then certainly addressing rent relief. You know, 60% of people in the Massachusetts 7th are renters. And so I love the legislation that Senator Harris has offered. If you make less than $100,000 and more than 30% of your income is going towards rent, you should get a tax break. Then the last is health care.
Big issue, big expense.
Big expense. And almost 60% of people in the Massachusetts 7th are living with pre-existing conditions. And so we were able to save the ACA. And when we have people that are developing GoFundMe pages to pay their medical bills, this is a watershed moment for our country. So
on this issue of economic inequality, I want to ask you about something that Deval Patrick said to me not long ago, not in reference to your campaign specifically, but on this issue. He actually surprised me, and he said words to the effect that inequality isn't necessarily a problem. He said the challenge is mobility, making sure that people have the means to move up in this economy. Do you agree with that? Do you see that as a distinction worth making?
You know, what I've been fighting for my entire life is social, racial, gender, and economic justice. And so a key component of that justice is mobility. I do think this is the most diverse district and the most unequal, and that is in large part because there hasn't been an equitable investment and because of policies over time that were discriminating and had a disproportionate impact on low-income immigrants and people of color. I'm well aware of those principles that sort of argue that inequality will always exist.
Right, right.
But, you know, this chasm and this divide is only widening and is only deepening, and it should not be that wide. So I've got a ton of ideas both in the macro and the micro, and I'm excited to get to work and see what is already out there that I can support and work actively to see passed, but also what I can create.
I want to talk to you about a little bit about President Trump in this moment in American politics. You made it clear that you weren't only running against President Trump, but you also have been very direct in your criticism, calling him racist, misogynist, responsible for any number of challenges to the 7th District coming out of his administration. Clearly, most of your constituents agree with you, but lots of people across America voted for Trump, including a million people here in Massachusetts, including many in your own district. So the question is, do you understand, or what is your explanation for why so many people supported this president in 2016?
You know, ultimately voting is a very personal, visceral decision. And he stoked the flames of a lot of things that I reject and that make me uncomfortable. But I think people are looking for authenticity. I think he moved people. It's my belief that he moved them in the wrong directions, and he stoked the flames of xenophobia and bigotry, and is really rolling back the hands of time when it comes to policy, our compassion, our empathy, our tolerance as a culture for differences. But I think ultimately that's what it was. He was authentically himself.
Authenticity, it sounds like.
I think it was that he was...
So the Democrats have to figure out how to be authentic.
I think, you know, listen, I ran a campaign talking about people in this district who have been ignored, left out, and left behind. Mm-hmm. Because I am Black and I'm a woman, people shorthand that and full-heartedly assume that I'm only talking about people of color. Mm. And I'm not. I'm talking about the electrician in Everett who sees their union rights being dismantled every day, the grandmother in Charlestown who's raising her grandchild because of the opioid epidemic, the artist in Somerville who doesn't feel seen as a worker and a contributor to this economy, the mother in Dorchester that can't afford childcare, you know, the cyclist in Cambridge that doesn't feel safe on the roadways. You know, we should not make assumptions. At some point or another, everyone has felt unseen and unheard and marginalized. And I think he struck a chord with many who feel marginalized and unseen and unheard and didn't believe that anyone else was speaking for them. And the ironic thing about that is many of those folks are people that have been under the Democratic tent. You know, that's the point, is that we're being presented with these false choices. We've always been the party of workers' rights. We've always been the party of the poor. You know, we have a long table of democracy here, and we are a big tent. And the way that we prove that and we model the values that we espouse is to go out and to be in community and to listen with and to spend time with those folks. And that is what we did in this campaign. So people don't need to be worried about whether or not, you know, I know how to work with everyone. I have been a city councilor in Boston representing an entire city for 8 years, earning the trust, the partnership, the confidence, and the votes of people throughout the city of Boston because I've always worked on those issues that are transcendent and resonant for people from every walk of life.
Councilor Presley, thank you so much for coming in, and again, congratulations.
Thank you.
Boston City Councilor Ayanna Pressley, who won last week's Democratic primary in the 7th Congressional District, talking to WBUR senior political reporter Anthony Brooks. Tomorrow on WBUR's Morning Edition, Anthony will have more on how Pressley's campaign stunned the political establishment and won. Stay with us. Coming up is Louisa May Alcott's Little Women, a book written 150 years ago, still relevant today. I'm Jill Kaufman. This is Radio Boston. Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jill Kaufman. The book, Little Women, set in Concord, Massachusetts, has never, ever gone out of print. And this month, a new movie interpretation will be in theaters. And then, starting in October, Greta Gerwig will be directing and filming in Massachusetts yet another Little Women movie set to star Meryl Streep. And there's even more. A BBC movie just came out as well. Why? Anne Boyd Rue may be able to explain. Anne Boyd Rue says that Louisa May Alcott's classic is as vital as ever. She's in our studio. She's a professor of English at the University of New Orleans, and her new book is called Meg, Jo, Beth, Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So, for sure, there are listeners who did not read Little Women. In a nutshell, can you give us the story about the March sisters?
Sure. Right. So these girls are growing up in Massachusetts. When the book starts, Amy's 12. She's the youngest sister. The oldest sister, Meg, is 16. And we watch them over the course of a year during the Civil War. Their father's away from home. And then the novel shifts to 3 years later. Meg's getting married and rest of the girls are growing up. So it's really a book about growing up.
So given all that young adult readers, have in front of them now, and that is not just the hard copy book, but the digital life, what is it that you make the case that still matters in Little Women, that you make the case, I imagine, for it to be read, but also that it's relevant in a larger cultural aspect?
It is, and I think looking at the history of the book and the relevance it's had to women over the generations, what really surprised me doing this work was how much impact Little Women has had, particularly on women writers over the years. So many women writers, and not just American, credit Jo March with giving them their first idea that maybe I could grow up and be a writer someday.
Jo, the writerly sister. So who can you list out for us so we can understand where the ripple effect has gone?
Right. So Anna Quinlan, Barbara Kingsolver, Sonia Sanchez, Bell Hooks, and my favorite, J.K. Rowling, talks about Jo March meaning so much to her. And so these, I think it's not too much to say that we wouldn't have certainly as many women writers we have today if they hadn't first encountered Jo March when they were young.
So this is where I'm stretching here, because there's so much now about identity, our race, our culture, where we come from, what country. I mean, there are countries all over the world that are that have interpretations of and translations of Little Women in their native language, but that young experience when we're talking about reading books that are largely about the value of being a young person, a young girl. How do you make relevant something that was written in the 19th century?
Well, for one, this is really one of the most
white children impoverished in eastern Massachusetts.
Right, right. So I think what's really important to realize is that this is one of the best and earliest books we have, and one of the only for many, many years, that talks about gender as something that you're not born with. It's something that you learn, right? So the girls are learning to become young women, and what does that mean exactly? And this is something that I think we're just now really starting to grapple with as a culture, is that, you know, there are lots of different ways to be a woman. There's lots of different ways to, you know, develop our gender identity. This is where kids are at now. They're really understanding gender in so many different ways, and Jo March was the original gender-bending heroine.
Yes, and the central question of Little Women was about who will I grow up to be and who will I grow up to marry and do I need to marry, which is where the interesting stuff starts to come in now, because there is no set way for young girls, nor has there ever been. It was just sort of prescribed that way by the by the economics of life. So if Alcott's central question was about who do I marry, again, how do you tell a 15-year-old or a 14-year-old, let's go a little bit younger, that is still relevant to what she's going to read?
Right, because I think it's important to remember that this was an Alcott's burning question. Who would the girls marry? This was her readers' burning question. She was getting letters from little girls saying, who wanted to know who the March sisters would marry. She said, as if that were the only end and aim of a woman's life, right? She was disappointed that she had to marry Joe off. She wanted Joe to remain a literary spinster like herself. And I think providing that context for girls and understanding the pressures that she felt she was under to, you know, marry Joe off are significant. But what's also interesting in the book, a couple of things, is the way marriage is portrayed. So first of all, marriage isn't the end. It's not the end for Meg. Meg gets married halfway through the book. And you know, you think of all the Austen novels, right? They all end in marriage. And we never see the, you know, Elizabeth Bennet, what things are like with Mr. Darcy. Well, we see what life is like with Meg and John Brooke. And it's not all rosy. It's really difficult making these transitions. I mean, Little Women is a book that older women can return to as well and get a lot from. And in the case of Jo, even though she does marry in the end, she makes a choice that is her choice. She doesn't pick the first guy who asks her to marry him, Laurie, the, you know, really wealthy boy next door. She makes her own decisions. And in fact, she asserts her right not to marry many points in the book. And when she does marry, she tells her husband that they are going to be partners, that she will earn the money with him. And so I think it's really, it can raise some interesting questions and have some interesting conversations about what marriage means to us now. And I think Alcott was pretty progressive in that respect.
Right. And I think that while you didn't write a biography here, like who Louisa May Alcott was really factors into maybe the reason an academic like yourself and others hold on to this book as something, because there was a great dichotomy, a great notion that she didn't want to write a book about girls. She didn't like girls, right? This is what she says. And she was so averse to writing Little Women. So how can you talk a bit about how that came about?
Well, if you think about Louisa, I mean, she is Jo March in so many respects. And it's hard to imagine Jo March growing up to write a book about girls because she's a tomboy, like Louisa herself was. She liked to play with boys, and they were her best friends. And she didn't really have a lot of interest in girls and girly things. And so she didn't like the idea initially because that's what she thought a girl's book should be, very girly. And as it turns out, what she gives us instead are four girls with very unique personalities who choose very different paths in life. I mean, you know, although three of the girls get married, they marry very different men and end up having very different lives as a result. And they make different choices along the way. And I think that's, you know, Louisa did what she could do within the context of, you know, the task that she was given and the constraints of that. And we see actually later in some of her later books, she does allow women to not marry. She has girls who grow up and assert their right to remain single, and she doesn't marry them off. And so she felt a bit freer to do that, even 18 years later in the novel Joe's Boys.
I don't want to get too much into what is or isn't in a canon of literature, but I am struck by how often we have in the last few years seen writers, filmmakers going back to 19th century characters in books, even earlier, and bringing them back, and that we watch them, we read them. There's a lot we still can get from a very different time, it seems. And academics are the ones that are helping us, you know, parse this with a right. feminist theory in the middle of, you know, what we didn't think was a feminist book, necessarily.
Right. I think there is a great, tremendous appeal and will continue to be. The more we get away from that period and more we realize how complex our lives are, there's some of the girls that I talked to when I was writing this book talked about how refreshing it was to just immerse themselves in this world where nobody had a device. Nobody was...
said in the right. mother of two teenagers. Sorry.
Right. I think it's really useful for them to realize what life was like when they, you know, they made their own home newspaper. They had their own theatricals. They made their own fun.
All right. So let's talk. We have 2 minutes or less. Literary heroines and non-literary heroines now. And there's a lot of Disney princesses. There's Beyonce. There's Gilmore Girls. There is Katniss from The Hunger Games. Those are some of the role models now, we don't know that they're role models, they're out there. Quickly, you took something. You took Mary Pfeiffer's social science on the sexuality, the hypersexuality of young girls, written in the 1990s, and gave it a treatment, a March Sisters treatment. Right. Were you, and without giving, you know, we can't explain too much about Mary Pfeiffer, but This was, Saving Ophelia, Rescuing, sorry, I'm blanking on the book name, Reviving Ophelia. And are you saying that even the March sisters were, there was a sexualization of going from girls to women in the 19th
century? Absolutely, absolutely. And it's kind of under the covers there because you couldn't really write about it too directly. But look at how the girls are having to wear their hair up. They're having to wear gloves now. They can't touch boys' hands at the ball. And they're having to wear their skirts long. And Joe isn't supposed to run anymore with Lori. She's supposed to be, you know, more prim and proper. And these are ways of signaling that these girls are becoming sexual beings. So they're no longer little
Would
girls.
Not have seen that without your guidance. So so thank you very much. And Boyd Rue, I wish you had a little bit more time to talk today. The book is called Meg Jo Beth Amy, The Story of Little Women and Why It Still Matters. Apparently it does. She will be at the Concord Bookshop tonight and the Boston Public Library tomorrow. You can get more information on our website, radioboston.org. And that is it for our show today. Radio Boston is a production of 90.9 WBUR, Boston's NPR news station. I'm Jill Kaufman. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.